Barbara, you describe yourself as a social entrepreneur and international educator with extensive work across markets and geographies, from nonprofits, financial services, primary and higher education, government and multilateral entities on five continents, and with a husband and a kids. That's quite a bit. And so I want to know, why do you think you're so driven?
Yeah, well, I guess we could start out with why I think I'm so driven, but I'd also like to comment on my CV. So I think it's always been the case. The best way to describe it is probably my mother, who loves to tell stories about me when I was young. She says that after I took my blood test to see what my blood type was, I called her up very excited because I was an A plus. And she also swears that I studied for my eye test. So I guess I'm not exactly sure why this is the case, but I suppose I've always been that way, and that's how I'm made. At the same time, I think my mother herself is a really big influence on my life. She's an educator. She's a woman who was the first person in her family to go to college, and she broke a lot of barriers, and it was extremely hardworking. So I'm sure that in addition to nature, there's a bit of nurture going on. Also, I'm pretty sure that deep-rooted anxiety plays some role in this. My father left home when I was young, and I'm sure that there's a little bit of having to prove myself happening here. But probably most importantly, there's also a deep interest. I'm a fairly curious person, so when there's a question that I really want to understand, I can't leave it alone until I do understand it or realize that it's just not going to be understood, at least by me, anyway.
So you grew up in Brooklyn, and I'm interested to know how you got from Brooklyn to all of those opportunities and experiences after.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, it's never a straight line, right? So it's you get there kind of one step at a time, and it's so much more organic than planned. But yes, I was born in Brooklyn above a bakery, and I grew up there and in Queens in New York. When you think Brooklyn, though, you may think trendy because it is quite trendy right now. But I was born in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and it was a completely different world back then. And it was a rather rough area. You may know Mike Tyson. He grew up there, too, right? I'm a second-generation immigrant from a rather humble background.
You mentioned that, you know, the way that I introduced you was how you tell the story about yourself through a professional CV or resume. And so I want to know how you describe yourself to people in different situations.
Yeah, well, never like that. Never. In fact, I've spent the past decade saying I'm Paul Freeman's wife. He's principal of Glenwood Springs High School. Or I'm Lena Leah's sister, and so forth. Never really describing myself head on. But I actually had a very funny experience fairly recently. I won some sort of award, and I was introduced to some very prestigious people all across Colorado. This was done on a Zoom meeting. So so there's a picture of me and a few lines of my bio there. And they said, Barbara, please, introduce yourself. And here I am, like, it's pretty prestigious. And I couldn't think of anything. Nothing came out of my mouth. So I read the few lines that were on that screen underneath my picture saying, I have a doctorate in education. I am, did I say I was Barbara Freeman? that's how I describe myself usually.
Well, so pretty humble, I would say.
I don't know, humble. Just, we all have our stories, don't we?
Initially, your interests and direction were in business and finance. And so what got you launched into Wall Street and a financial career from Brooklyn?
Yeah, I mean, when I graduated from university, I actually did very well at university. I studied political science and economics, and growing up in New York when I did, it's just a logical thing. You go to Wall Street, and if you did well at school. And so I remember actually having two ads sitting there at one time. In fact, I had two job offers at one time. One was at a Union Bank of Switzerland, which is the Wall Street job that I took, and the other one was a job in upstate New York in economic development. And I decided to go for the money. I had student loans, and I don't come from a great wealth.
You started at the UBS Bank and then co-founded KPMG's consulting risk management practice in Southeast Asia. How old were you when you did that?
Oh, I don't even know. I guess I was in my 30s.
Okay.
30-something, yeah.
In your experience with risk management and thinking about the pandemic and the onset of the pandemic about a year ago, I am interested to know, in a nutshell, can you tell us about how one goes about developing a risk management strategy for any sort of entity? How does one prepare for the unexpected?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I guess, in short, the first step of any risk management strategy is to identify the various risks. These could be financial and credit risk, all the way to operational and shareholder risks. Risk can be big or small, and what you need to do is rank them in terms of the impact. So how big a problem if something goes wrong? And also the likelihood of occurrence. So how likely is this going to be to happen? So for example, many risks are likely to occur, but the impact is tiny if they happen. Take a weather forecast says that it might rain later, but you go out without your umbrella, right? Other risks are low probability, but serious problems if they occur. So these are the kinds of risks that you need to put a plan in place to lower the risk. So for example, the risk that your house is going to get flooded, you go and buy flood insurance or hazard insurance. But one other piece, though, that if you're working in an organizational level that's really important is that risk doesn't automatically translate into bad things. There's often opportunity in risk. So again, it's back to the identification and understanding of the cause of that risk. And then the question becomes, how can you turn this potential threat into an advantage or into a business opportunity?
And does your experience within risk management have an impact on how you manage risks in your own life now?
That's a really funny question about managing risk in my own life. When you were talking about KPMG, and I co-founded a KPMG consulting practice in Asia, in Southeast Asia, and I lived in Kuala Lumpur. And while we were living in Kuala Lumpur, we had my second child, and we decided to come and take the maternity leave here in the Roaring Fork Valley, in Glenwood, and then in Carbondale. And when we were here, we decided to buy a piece of land and build a house here. Now, listen, do not ever try to build a house when you live halfway around the world. And we ran into problems. Our builder almost brought us to bankruptcy. And my brother-in-law at the time kept asking us, what's your plan? And my husband and I would look at each other and we'd say, well, we don't have one. I guess we probably should, and we probably should have, by the way, because I ended up quitting my job in Kuala Lumpur, moving to the Valley full-time. And at the time, we were moving to Singapore from Kuala Lumpur, from Malaysia, and we literally, no joke, relabeled the boxes, crossed out the word Singapore, and put the address in Carbondale instead. So managing risk in my own life is a little bit different. I guess I would add just one more thing. Maybe at a family level, we do manage some risk, right? We often, my husband and I often talk and say we're like stocks and bonds. right? Paul, my husband, is the bond, right? He has a steady and a stable job as a high school principal, and I'm more like a stock, and there could be wild variations in what I do year to year, generally rising over time, I think, but the two come together, right, to make it work.
And so you, in your banking and financial career, you did a lot, but then there was a crucial transition point in your life, and clearly you transitioned into the field of education, and you decided to follow a new career path. You've always been adjacent to education through your mother and husband, but why did you decide to change careers, and at what point did you decide that?
Yeah, I would say that it probably all stems from, you just put it really nicely, by the way. And I think a lot of it also stems from a passion and a curiosity in both education and economics, and how those two can go hand in hand. And, you know, for as long as I can remember, I have thought about issues of inequality and fairness, and its persistence, and we can call that social justice and economic justice if you'd like. Through all my travels and work and living in different places, I've seen how certain populations are marginalized and lack basic freedoms and generally suffer across the globe. And I've also studied and worked in places it's less part of daily life and less inequality, like Denmark. I guess the important piece is when I first moved to the Roaring Fork Valley, and again, after growing up in New York and living in multicultural places, I was struck by the fact that essentially here, there were two communities, if you'd like, Anglos and the Latinx community, and I really wanted to understand some of the differences between the two, and I was particularly curious about the some of the educational differences and disparities. My children were young, and I was just kind of figuring it all out. So I dove into this question, which led to more questions, which eventually turned into a doctoral thesis in educational leadership for change or for social justice, and becoming a visiting scholar at Berkeley, still in pursuit of those answers. But it's never, just because of how I operate in the world, it's never enough to just solve a problem theoretically. I also like to create an intervention, so something that deals with the problem, or possibly, and see if we could, if what this idea can do can make any kind of change or any kind of difference, even a little, in the real world. And not just to throw it out there, but to throw it out there and test it and improve it and see if it does make a difference. Because of my experience and all my experience always brought in some sort of digital technology, both in the background, because digital technology is defining our lives and our society, and it's changing. It's changing how we live, how we work, how we interact with one another, and obviously all the economic possibilities. And it's also changing education. And so I've been very, very focused and curious about how digital technologies can be used to support learning. And that's both inside schools, in a K-12 experience, and in lifelong learning experience with adults as well.
And just thinking about your academic career, you have done a lot of consulting work with World Bank, but you also have an incredible list of experience projects and publications. Are there any of which you're particularly proud?
Each one's a struggle, and I'm proud of all of them. I think that there's a piece that I really worked on inequality and digital technologies, and another piece where I wrote a social innovators framework, which was the skills and capabilities that people need to become social entrepreneurs who can change the world. I think that was also a very important piece to me.
I'm just kind of thinking back to that critical point when you decided that you wanted to leave your financial career. And there was a point where you had a horse riding accident, I believe. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah. I was actually visiting Ireland for a weekend, well, a long weekend anyway, to first learn how to horseback ride, and then to eventually gallop along the sea. I never made it that far. I was new to horse riding. I sat down on the horse quite confident because I'm athletic, but the horse was not fooled, and it threw me, and I fell off the horse. I broke L1 and L2. I was paralyzed, only waistband, though.
And you since then have fully recovered?
I fully recovered from that accident, but it was a long one. I spent 2 months in hospital in Dublin, and that was followed by 2 months in a full fiberglass body cast. So I was originally meant to do an MBA in England and in London, but I couldn't move and I couldn't leave the country. So people from Trinity College in Dublin came and interviewed me by my bedside, and that's changed the trajectory of my life, really.
Wow. And then, so you were introduced and you came to the Valley because your sister lived here. And does she still live here?
She does.
Okay.
Yeah, she lives here. And I think just about everyone up and down the Valley know my sister, Lynn.
So you were here, and then you've obviously had a really global life. But then you began working with marginalized communities here in this Valley, and combined with economics and financial literacy. You are the founder of La Medici. And before we talk about the big year that La Medici's had, I would like you to give a quick rundown of what La Medici is for our listeners.
Sure. Well, thank you. Yeah. La Medici essentially are savings clubs. And the mission of La Medici is to enable people outside of mainstream banking to achieve financial security. These are people that may be underbanked or unbanked. And the idea behind La Medici is simple. The idea is to help people save and to build the habit of saving. We combine the trust of a community savings with the security and ease of using a mobile app. So it is secure, it's easy to use, and it's 100% mobile. And it's multilingual, in fact. So the default is actually Spanish, but it's in English and Portuguese as well. There are no fees, there's data security and seamless online money transfer. Connected to this is a whole messaging system. And so essentially La Medici is a safe place to save and to earn a distribution or incentives, really, on one's savings. We support people as they build the habit of savings through various means, such as nudges, and just to take away what that means. a nudge could be a contextual reminder through a text message to help people save. It could be positive feedback. Every time somebody saves, they receive a text message, an immediate balance update letting them know that they've saved. It can be visualization of a person's progress toward achieving a longer-term savings goal. But essentially what we're trying to do is get people to build the habit of savings and to build an emergency savings fund so that in case there's an emergency, people have funds that they can take out in case of emergency or unexpected expense.
I wanted to know, you mentioned that you are working with the unbanked and underbanked population. What do those two terms mean?
Yep. So the unbanked is population is quite easy. They don't have a bank account, right? And I would say that, in fact, close to 80 to 85% of the immigrant community actually does have a bank account. And so that's the easy definition of unbanked. Underbanked is a little bit more difficult because people have a bank account, but the bank account may not have full services, or people may not have access to low-cost loans, for example. So they may lack access to some of the more convenient or affordable banking services.
And I'm assuming, but you can correct me, that La Medici came about due to or because of your research in this area of the un and underbanked. Is that how La Medici started?
Yeah, I mean, a combination of that, right? Yes, that's an essential piece of it. Experience globally with alternative ways to save. But also it started in conversation with George Stranahan. George Stranahan is a great philanthropist in our area, and he's followed my work for years. He's at Manaus. In conversation, we talked about needs in the Latinx community, and we weren't exactly sure what those needs were. Under Manaus, I conducted a survey in the Valley of the Latinx community to really understand what the needs are of the community members. And together we decided to, we both had theories of and an idea that there may be some struggles in the Latinx community and immigrant communities with the kind of issues that we've been discussing. And we set out to understand more, to talk to people, to survey people, and to really understand what are people's financial needs.
So it really started with connecting with the community and listening to the needs of the community.
Absolutely. I would say that empathy is at the heart of everything, really, that you try to build. And the way I would define it even more is trying to kind of step back and understand something, right, from another person or another community's point of view. And so the key to all of that is listening, really listening without judging. And sometimes when you're trying to solve a big problem, there's the issue of just listening to many voices to understand, you know, how people see things. Sometimes you need this same kind of listening empathy skill when you're speaking with an individual, because you've got to stop whatever noise is in your head or what you think you know about how the world works. But this is, first of all, the roots of where La Medici started. And even more importantly, I've really learned about listening and empathy from my colleagues at La Medici. And that's important.
You mentioned ambassadors. Can you tell me a little bit more about who the ambassadors are and why they're so important to La Medici?
Sure. The La Medici ambassadors are actually all from different backgrounds and countries. Several people are from, we have a team of five. So a few are from Mexico, someone is from Colombia, and from El Salvador. So there's a nice mix. They are the people that work with the community and community members to talk to them, to help them build this habit of savings, to understand where they are and where their goals are. So we have educational tools, the digital technologies that assist in this process, but it's really a process of one-on-one people talking to people.
In thinking about La Medici and the purpose of La Medici and thinking about underbanked communities, I've read that immigrant communities make use of payday loans because they have little choice. Do you find that La Medici can be a replacement for these payday loans?
Not exactly. So let me just take that question back a little bit, right? Yes, it's true that people may have little choice. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's true that makes people with fewer choices vulnerable to predatory behavior, mm-hmm. right? But to cover, say, an emergency or an unexpected expense, often people will actually stop paying a bill, such as a gas bill or rent, and instead accept paying higher fees and penalties. And some will go into further debt, and then you can see this especially with medical bills and expenses. particularly in the immigrant community, many people turn to their friends and family, and they'll lend and borrow from them. And then sometimes people will actually borrow at very high rates of interest or fees from people that have the potential to exercise some power over them and act in a predatory way. There's things that Lamadici can do, and I'd also like to talk about things that can be done beyond Lamadici. Just starting with Lamadici, what Lamadici, again, is focused on is really helping people build their savings so that they have a financial cushion so that if there's an unexpected expense or an emergency, they'll be able to borrow against that, take it out, that they will have saved the money themselves. And I think that's a really important piece. Also with Lamadici, as a person builds the habit of savings, it really doesn't matter what their credit score is anywhere else or what they've done, or what their credit history could look like, or even if they don't have one. If you've begun to save consistently at Lamadici, we will provide micro loans in case of emergency. And I think that's important. That said, people have real-life dreams and need to acquire assets. What do I mean by that? Buy cars, importantly, buy a home. Mm-hmm. And Lamadici is not going to be able to get someone there. But what Lamadici can do is help people build this habit of savings and make a connection so that a person can graduate from Lamadici into a real financial institution. We are a nonprofit, right? We operate as a nonprofit. But graduate into a bank or a credit union, having acquired a history at Lamadici of saving, and perhaps of borrowing these micro loans and repaying them, and we can pass them on to the banks or credit unions, where they then will be eligible for low-cost loans that can allow them to buy these bigger, purchases at a low cost.
You mentioned the word empathy, and, I'm sure your ambassadors have developed a sense of empathy and have empathy as well, and that's why they are successful out in the field. And then I'm assuming that just some of the hardships that you've had in your life and your background have helped you develop an empathy to be able to do this really difficult work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And I think that it's, as I talked about before, the key to this is listening. I would say also, though, alongside for me, alongside empathy, there are other important factors. And what I mean is, many of the problems that I've tried to deal with through my work are not individual; they are structural issues. And there's empathy on the two levels. So if you're talking about the empathy of the ambassador, an ambassador needs to be empathetic when they're speaking with someone, when they're listening to someone. Sometimes, a person can be angry or emotional, and that's understandable why they may be that way. And it's really important to kind of stop and think, this isn't about me, right? This is an issue that someone is dealing with, you've got to get beyond that noise in your head, mm-hmm. right? And understand what the nature of that issue. Alongside empathy, there are other things, right? A person could be living in a difficult situation because there are structural barriers to their opportunity. And I believe really strongly that if you have privilege, as I do now, then you have a responsibility to do what you can to make the situation better. In fact, you can even say that there's some moral imperative to do so, but really the heart of it is that there's a responsibility to take action. Yet importantly, you just can't do that action alone. And I think the best way to explain this is is I've practiced and used human-centered design. I will call it user-centered design in my work. And in fact, it's one of the core principles of Manaus as an organization. Human-centered design is a process that's meant to solve a problem by really listening, right, and meeting the needs of that person. Again, not what you think those needs are, but the actual needs. And I think the most important aspect of user-centered design, in my opinion, is that you're solving a problem with the community, with a person, or with the community at large. You're not solving it for the community. And in fact, that the latter will never work anyway because it's not sustainable. So the idea behind empathy for me is finding a solution to a real problem that people care about and then working collaboratively with the community and creatively with the community to solve it.
I am really interested to know, because you work with the Latinx community here in the Valley, and you're obviously working toward help people gain financial literacy through La Merici. What other resources do you think are missing for that population in our Valley and for other vulnerable populations?
So many. there's just many opportunities that you may not have access to if you're in an immigrant community. And luckily in our Valley, there are many fabulous social organizations working on things. I'd say, you know, starting with things like housing, but moving to working on building English skills and food security and many, especially given the pandemic, so many issues. There's also some really interesting efforts that I've been working on together with the Bell Policy Center, which is in Denver, and that's working on issues related to financial empowerment. And this is really finding, I've been working as part of a coalition to build a statewide office of financial empowerment. And in fact, a bill just passed to create this office of financial empowerment. But it also sets up, and this is the really interesting part, a network of organizations, right, and offices of financial empowerment across the state.
What does this type of office look like?
Yeah, so think more network than office of financial empowerment, because there's an opportunity here there are cities of financial empowerment. In fact, cities all across the country. Denver has one, so does New York, San Francisco, and Detroit, you know, all big cities. We, in Colorado, are creating the very first ever statewide office, which means that a place like the Roaring Fork Valley actually will have access to different resources. So what is financial empowerment? Well, it could do many different things. It could help connect people to trusted resources and information. So, for example, help with tax preparation or finding out Social Security, you know, how to claim it. It can help, importantly, with debt reduction through free one-on-one counseling. It could provide access to safe and low-cost bank products, improve credit score, help with eviction or foreclosure, you know, many of the issues that we've been discussing.
La Merici has been around for 3 years, as you've said, and this past year through the pandemic, you've had a really big year. Do you want to talk a little bit about the year that you've had?
Yeah, it's been an intense year, as it has been for everyone. We've talked about what La Medici does and what Manaus does, and early on when the pandemic struck last April, we created the Manaus Emergency Fund, and the Manaus Emergency Fund provides direct assistance to the Latinx community, the immigrant community. In the form of $1,000 direct assistance, $950 going direct and 50 going into a Lama Dichi savings account so that people are prepared and have something in their account to get them started for the future and to start to build that habit. In addition, Lama Dichi was really well positioned to do this because of our mobile app and our, and more importantly, even our digital technologies and our back office that can handle all the analytics and distribution of funds and is safe and secure and private and all the rest of those things that you need to have in place if you're going to distribute money. Wow. So we use the Lama Dichi facility as a back office, right, in order to send out funds in this safe way. We also work with the Left Behind Workers Fund, which does roughly what the Manaus Emergency Fund does, $1,000 grants, but on a much larger scale statewide. Hmm. They're located in Denver, but work across the state. And we became part of, if you'd like, the Left Behind Workers family as well, and one of the vetting and distribution channels. Between the Manaus Emergency Fund and the Left Behind Workers Fund, Lama Dichi has distributed over $3 million, which is roughly 3,000 families and somewhere around 12,000 to 15,000 people that we've been able to help this past year.
How could listeners or friends of listeners get in touch or start using Lama Dichi?
It's actually very easy to register. You could do it on the phone. It's lamedichi.org.
Okay.
LAMEDICHI.org. And it's a very, and for the registration process, right, without even just writing to us, you could put in lamedichi.org/OLA, H-O-L-A.
Barbara, your work sounds fascinating, and you just keep going. And in another conversation that we've had, you have talked about the fact that, and it's clear from your work history and experience, that you like to start things. You're really good at starting new things. What do you think you are going to do next?
I am going to continue to build Lama Dichi. This is what I'm going to do. We've been going now for 3 years since we've started, and all the pieces are coming together. We have a new social investor in Lama Dichi. We are our new independent nonprofit, and we have a lot of goals and a lot of, as I've been talking about, and a lot of growth to do. So it's really about continuing to build this out.
I'll be excited to see what's next for Lama Dichi and how it grows. Great. Wow, Barbara. Well, I've really enjoyed learning about Lama Dichi and the really important work that you're doing. Looking back at your career and where you started in finance and moving through into education and then kind of marrying the two, economics and education together, how would you describe the trajectory of your life and career?
I think that, as I said earlier, things happen more organically. And I think one step leads into another, and suddenly it's a life.
Well, Barbara, thank you so much for being here on KD&K and Other Plans. And I look forward to seeing what Lama Dichi and you do moving forward.
Yeah, well, Abigail, thank you so much for these wonderful, thought-provoking questions and for your time and your interest. And